uprooting it. The third premise is that the essential nature of mind is pure. It is based on the belief that the underlying basic subtle consciousness is untainted by negative emotions. Its nature is pure, a state which is referred to as the mind of clear light. That basic nature of the mind is also called Buddha nature. So since negative emotions are not an intrinsic part of this Buddha nature, there is a possibility to eliminate them and purify the mind.
The Dalai Lama's method of achieving full potential and becoming happy is radically different from most Western approaches. While we're used to the idea, for example, of using psychotherapeutic techniques such as behavior therapy to attack specific bad habits such as smoking, drinking, or temper flares, we are not accustomed to systematically cultivating positive attributes, love, compassion, generosity, as weapons against all negative states. The Dalai Lama's method for achieving happiness is based on the revolutionary idea that negative mental states are not an intrinsic part of our minds. They are transient obstacles that obstruct the expression of our underlying natural state of joy and happiness. And these obstacles can be neutralized through the antidotes, or the corresponding positive mental states. And when this discipline, derived from Buddhist thought, is viewed in the light of scientific evidence showing that we can change the very structure and function of the brain by establishing new conditioning that comes about by deliberately cultivating new ways of thinking, then the idea that we can achieve happiness through training of the mind seems a very real possibility.
Chapter 13. Dealing with Anger and Hatred.
If one comes across a person who has been shot by an arrow, one does not spend time wondering about where the arrow came from, or the caste of the individual who shot it, or analyzing the type of wood the shaft is made of, or the manner in which the arrowhead was fashioned. Rather, one should focus on immediately pulling out the arrow. This observation of the Buddhas leads us to the next step in the Dalai Lama's approach to reshaping our minds and hearts. The Dalai Lama now turns to some of the arrows, the negative states of mind that destroy our happiness, beginning with the discussion of anger and hatred.
Generally speaking, there are many different kinds of afflictive or negative emotions, such as conceit, arrogance, jealousy, desire, lust, close-mindedness, and so on. But out of all these, hatred and anger are considered to be the greatest evil because they are the greatest obstacle to developing compassion and altruism, and they destroy one's virtue and calmness of mind. Now, under rare circumstances, some kinds of anger can be positive. When motivated by compassion, it can act as a powerful force to bring about swift and decisive action. But generally speaking, anger leads to ill feeling and hatred, and hatred is never positive. It has no benefit at all. It is always totally negative. The destructive effects of hatred are very visible, very obvious, and immediate. For example, when a very strong or forceful thought of hatred arises within you, at that very instant it totally overwhelms you and destroys your peace of mind. Your presence of mind disappears completely. When such intense anger and hatred arises, it obliterates the best part of your brain, which is the ability to judge between right and wrong, and the long-term and short-term consequences of your actions. Your power of judgment becomes totally inoperable. It can no longer function. It is almost like you have become insane. Even at the physical level, hatred brings about a very ugly, unpleasant physical transformation of the individual. For reasons such as these, hatred is compared to an enemy. This inner enemy has no other function than causing you harm, destroying us, both in the immediate term and the long term. It is your true enemy, your ultimate enemy. This is very different from an ordinary enemy. Although an ordinary enemy may engage in activities that are harmful to us, At least he or she has many other functions. That person has got to eat and sleep. He or she cannot devote 24 hours a day of his or her existence to this project of destroying us. On the other hand, hatred has no other function, no other purpose than destroying us. So realizing this fact, you should resolve that you will never give an opportunity for this enemy, hatred, to arise within you. We cannot overcome anger and hatred simply by suppressing them. We need to actively cultivate the antidotes to hatred, patience and tolerance. When you are engaged in the practice of patience and tolerance, in reality, what is happening is you are engaged in a combat with hatred and anger. Since it is a situation of combat, you seek victory. But you also have to be prepared for the possibility of losing that battle. So while you are engaged in combat, you should not lose sight of the fact that in the process, you will confront many problems. You should have the ability to withstand these hardships. Someone who gains victory through such an arduous process is a true hero. In some cases, people harbor strong feelings of anger and hurt based on something done to them in the past. And that feeling is kept bottled up. Under such circumstances, there is a Tibetan expression which says that if there is any sickness in the conch shell, if anything is blocking the shell, you can clear it out by blowing it out. Similarly, it is possible to imagine a situation in which, due to the bottling up of certain emotions, it may be better to just let it out and express it. However, I believe that generally speaking, anger and hatred are the type of emotions which, if you leave them unchecked or unattended, they tend to aggravate and keep on increasing. So, if you work toward building inner contentment and cultivating kindness and compassion, this brings about a certain calmness of mind that can help prevent anger from arising in the first place. And then when a situation does arise which makes you angry, you should directly confront your anger and analyze it. Investigate what factors have given rise to that particular instance of anger or hatred. Then, analyze further, seeing whether it is an appropriate response, and especially whether it is constructive or destructive. And you make an effort to exert a certain inner discipline and restraint, actively combating it by applying the antidotes, counteracting these negative emotions with thoughts of patience and tolerance. It's clear that in seeking to eliminate anger and hatred, the intentional cultivation of patience and tolerance is indispensable. In our everyday life experiences, tolerance and patience have great benefits. For instance, developing them will allow us to be able to sustain and maintain our presence of mind. Although you may have experienced many negative events in the past with the development of patience and tolerance, it is possible to let go of your sense of anger and resentment. If you analyze the situation, you will realize that the past is past, so there is no use continuing to feel anger and hatred, which does not change the situation, but just causes a disturbance within your mind and causes you continued unhappiness. Another benefit of responding to difficult situations with patience rather than giving in to anger is that you protect yourself from potential undesirable consequences which might come about if you reacted with anger. Because if you respond to situations with anger and hatred, not only does it not protect you from the injury or harm that has already been done to you, but on top of that, you create an additional cause for your own suffering in the future. Since patience or tolerance comes from an ability to remain firm and steadfast, and not to be overwhelmed by the adverse situations or conditions that one faces. One should not see tolerance or patience as a sign of weakness or giving in, but rather as a sign of strength coming from a deep ability to remain firm. Responding to a trying situation with patience and tolerance, rather than reacting with anger and hatred, involves active restraint, which comes from a strong, self-disciplined mind. I think there is a very close connection between humility and patience. Humility involves having the capacity to take a more confrontational stance, having the capacity to retaliate if you wish, yet deliberately deciding not to do so. That is what I would call genuine humility. Now, when we talk about how one should develop tolerance towards those who harm us, one should not misunderstand this to mean that we should just meekly accept whatever is done against us. Sometimes, you might encounter situations that require strong countermeasures. I believe, however, that one can take a strong stand and even take strong countermeasure out of a feeling of compassion or a sense of concern for the other, rather than out of anger. One of the reasons why there is a need to adopt a very strong countermeasure against someone is that if you let the harm or the crime that is being perpetuated against you pass, then there is a danger of that person habituating it in a very negative way, which, in reality, will cause that individual's own downfall and is very destructive in the long run for the individual himself or herself. So you can take countermeasures out of a feeling of compassion and concern for that individual. In Buddhism, a lot of attention is paid to our attitudes towards our rivals or enemies. This is because hatred can be the greatest stumbling block to the development of compassion and happiness. If you can learn to develop patience and tolerance towards your enemies, then everything else becomes much easier. Your compassion towards all others then begins to flow naturally. An end result of patience and tolerance is forgiveness.
Fourth and fifth meditations on anger.
Begin to work with the Dalai Lama's ideas on using patience and tolerance to neutralize anger and hatred through these two simple yet effective meditations.
Fourth meditation.
Let us imagine a scenario where someone that you know very well, someone who is close or dear to you, is in a situation where the person loses his or her temper. You can imagine this occurring either in a very acrimonious relationship or in a situation where something personally upsetting is happening. The other person is so angry that he or she has lost all of his or her mental composure, creating very negative vibrations, even going to the extent of beating himself or herself up or breaking things. Then reflect upon the immediate effects of this person's rage. You'll see a physical transformation happening to him or her. This person whom you feel close to, whom you like, the very sight of whom gave you pleasure in the past, now turns into this ugly person, even physically speaking. The reason why I think we should visualize this happening to someone else is because it is easier to see the faults of others than to see one's own faults. So using your imagination, do this meditation and visualization for a few minutes. At the end of that visualization, analyze the situation and relate the circumstance to your own experience. See that you yourself have been in this state many times. Resolve that I shall never let myself fall under the sway of such intense anger and hatred, because if I do that, I will also be in the same position. I will also suffer all these consequences, lose my peace of mind, lose my composure, assume this ugly physical appearance, and so on. So once you make that decision, then for the last few minutes of the meditation, focus your mind on that conclusion without further analysis. Simply let your mind remain on your resolution not to fall under the influence of anger and hatred.
Fifth meditation.
Begin by visualizing someone whom you dislike, someone who annoys you, causes a lot of problems for you, or gets on your nerves. Then imagine a scenario where the person irritates you or does something that offends you or annoys you. And in your imagination, when you visualize this, let your natural response follow. Just let it flow naturally. See how you feel. See whether that causes the rate of your heartbeat to go up, and so on. Examine whether you are comfortable or uncomfortable. See if you immediately become more peaceful or if you develop an uncomfortable mental feeling. Judge for yourself. Investigate. So, for a few minutes, 3 or 4 minutes perhaps, judge and experiment. And then at the end of your investigation, if you discover that, yes, it is of no use to allow that irritation to develop, immediately I lose my peace of mind, then say to yourself, in the future, I will never do that. Develop that determination. Finally, for the last few minutes of the exercise, place your mind single pointedly upon that conclusion or determination. So that's the meditation.
Chapter 14, Self-Hatred and Human Potential.
Of course we love ourselves. How can a person hate himself or herself?
Buddhist philosophy has a well-entrenched methodology for dealing with hatred and anger that is directed outward. But the idea of self-hatred, of hatred turned inward, was astonishing to the Dalai Lama when he first heard of it. In fact, he only learned of the existence of self-hatred and its prevalence in Western culture during a conference with a group of Western scientists and psychologists held at his home in Dharamsala in 1991. As he became more familiar with the concept, he began to see ways in which the Buddhist doctrine could help one counteract this punishing impulse.
When these people began speaking about self-hatred, at first I wasn't certain if I was understanding the concept correctly. Although I thought that I had some understanding of how the mind works, this ideal of hating oneself was completely new to me. The reason why I found it quite so unbelievable is that, as practicing Buddhists, we are working very hard in trying to overcome our self-centered attitude, our selfish thoughts and motives. From this viewpoint, I think we love and cherish ourselves too much. So to think of this possibility of someone hating themselves was quite, quite unbelievable. From the Buddhist point of view, being in a depressed state, in a state of discouragement, is seen as a kind of an extreme, which can clearly be an obstacle to taking the steps necessary to accomplish one's goals. A state of self-hatred is even far more extreme than simply being discouraged, and this can be very, very dangerous. For those engaged in Buddhist practice, the antidote to self-hatred would be to reflect upon the fact that all beings, including oneself, have Buddha nature, the seed or potential for perfection. Full enlightenment, no matter how weak or poor or deprived one's present situation may be. So those who suffer from self-hatred or self-loathing should avoid contemplating the suffering nature of existence or the underlying unsatisfactory nature of existence. And instead, they should concentrate more on the positive aspects of their existence, such as appreciating the tremendous potential that lies within oneself as a human being. And by reflecting on these opportunities and potentials, they will be able to increase their sense of worth and confidence in themselves. We are gifted human beings with this wonderful human intelligence. On top of that, all human beings have the capacity to be very determined and to direct that strong sense of determination in whatever direction they would like to use it. There is no doubt of this. So, if one maintains an awareness of these potentials and reminds oneself of them repeatedly until it becomes part of one's customary way of perceiving human beings, including oneself, then this could serve to help reduce feelings of discouragement, helplessness, and self-contempt. I think there might be some sort of parallel to the way we treat physical illness. When doctors treat someone for a specific illness, not only do they give antibiotics for the specific condition, but they also make sure that the person's underlying physical condition is such that he or she can take antibiotics and tolerate it. So, in order to ensure that, the doctors make sure, for instance, that the person is generally well-nourished. And often they may also have to give vitamins or whatever to build the body. So long as the person has that underlying strength in his or her body, then there is the potential or capacity within the body to heal itself from the illness through medication. Similarly, so long as we know and maintain an awareness that we have this marvelous gift of human intelligence and a capacity to develop determination and use it in positive ways, in some sense, we have this underlying mental health and underlying strength that comes from realizing we have this great human potential. This realization can act as a sort of built-in mechanism which allows us to deal with any difficulty, no matter what situation we are facing, without losing hope or sinking into self-hatred.
There is a popular notion in our culture, shared by many contemporary psychotherapists, that self-hatred is rampant within our society. And since we tend to view the world from the perspective of our own cultures, this has led to the assumption that it is a widespread human problem, possibly even an ingrained feature of the human psyche. But the very fact that the Dalai Lama was completely unaware of the very existence of self-hatred until fairly recently, and that it may be virtually unheard of in entire cultures, strongly reminds us that this troubling mental state, like all of the other negative states we have considered, is not an intrinsic part of the human mind. It is not something we are born with, irrevocably saddled with, nor is it an indelible characteristic of our nature. This realization alone can serve to weaken its power, give us hope, and increase our commitment to eliminate it. When first hearing of the concept of self-hatred, the Dalai Lama's initial reaction was, "Hate oneself? Of course we love ourselves." For those who suffer from low self-esteem or self-hatred, or know someone who does, this response may seem incredibly naive at first glance. But on closer investigation, there may be a penetrating truth in his response. Love is difficult to define, and there may be many different definitions. But one definition of love, and perhaps the most pure and exalted kind of love, is an utter, absolute, and unqualified wish for the happiness of another individual. A heartfelt wish for the other's happiness regardless of whether he does something to injure us, or even whether we like him. Now, deep in our hearts, there's no question that every one of us wants to be happy. So, if our definition of love is based on a genuine wish for someone's happiness, then each of us does, in fact, love himself or herself. Every one of us sincerely wishes for his or her own happiness. So perhaps the Dalai Lama was not far off the mark in his belief that all of us have this underlying self-love. And this idea suggests a powerful antidote to self-hatred. We can directly counteract thoughts of self-contempt by reminding ourselves that no matter how much we may dislike some of our characteristics, underneath it all, we wish ourselves to be happy. And that is a profound kind of love.
Part 5. Closing Reflections. Chapter 15. The Spiritual Life and Spiritual Values.
Religion should be a remedy to help reduce the conflict and suffering in the world, not another source of conflict.
The art of happiness has many components. As we've seen, it begins with developing an understanding of the truest sources of happiness and basing our priorities in life on the cultivation of those sources. It involves an inner discipline, a gradual process of rooting out destructive mental states and replacing them with positive, constructive ones, such as kindness, tolerance, and forgiveness. In identifying the factors that lead to a full and satisfying life, we conclude with a discussion of the final component, spirituality. There is a natural tendency to associate spirituality with religion. The Dalai Lama's approach to achieving happiness has been shaped by his years of rigorous training as an ordained Buddhist monk. He's also widely regarded as a preeminent Buddhist scholar. For many, however, it is not his grasp of complex philosophical issues that offers the most appeal, but rather his personal warmth, humor, down-to-earth approach to life, and his ability to relate to people as simply one human being to another. Despite his position as one of the most prominent religious figures in the world, it is clear that he does not regard adherence to any one religion as the only form of spirituality.
I believe that it is essential to appreciate our potential as human beings and to recognize the importance of inner transformation. This should be achieved through what could be called a process of mental development. Sometimes I call this having a spiritual dimension in one's life. There can be two levels of spirituality. One level of spirituality has to do with one's religious beliefs. In this world, there are so many different people, so many different dispositions. There are 5 billion human beings, and in a certain way, I think we need 5 billion different religions. I believe that each individual should embark upon a spiritual path that is best suited to his or her mental disposition, temperament, belief, family, and cultural background. Now, for example, as a Buddhist monk, I find Buddhism to be most suitable. So, for myself, I found that Buddhism is best. But that does not mean Buddhism is best for everyone. The purpose of religion is to benefit people. And I think that if we only had one religion, after a while it would cease to benefit many people. If you had a restaurant, for instance, and it only served one dish day after day for every meal, that restaurant wouldn't have many customers left after a while. People need and appreciate diversity in their food because there are so many different tastes. In the same way, religions are meant to nourish the human spirit, and I think we can learn to celebrate that diversity and develop a deep appreciation of the variety of religions. So, certain people may find Judaism, the Christian tradition, or the Islamic tradition to be the most effective for them. Therefore, we must respect and appreciate the value of all the different major world religious traditions. I think that one way of strengthening the mutual respect is through closer contact between those of different religious faiths, personal contact. I have made efforts over the past few years to meet and have dialogues with the Christian community and the Jewish community, and I think that some really positive results have come of this. Through this kind of closer contact, we can learn about the useful contributions that these religions have made to humanity and find useful aspects of other traditions that we can learn from. We may even discover methods and techniques that we can adopt in our own practice. All of these religions can make an effective contribution for the benefit of humanity. They are all designed to make the individual a happier person and the world a better place. However, in order for the religion to have an impact in making the world a better place, I think it's important for the individual practitioner to sincerely practice the teachings of that religion. You must integrate the religious teachings into your life, wherever you are, so you can use it as a source of inner strength. And you must gain a deeper understanding of the religion's ideas, not just on an intellectual level, but with a deep feeling, making it part of your inner experience. There are so many things that divide humanity, so many problems in the world. Religion should be a remedy to help reduce the conflict and suffering in the world, not another source of conflict. So it is essential that we develop closer bonds among the various religions. Through this, we can make a common effort for the benefit of humanity.
During the Dalai Lama's week of public talks in Tucson, he spoke about his own practices of prayer and meditation, and ways to make the spiritual life part of one's inner experience.
I think prayer is, for the most part, simple daily reminders of your deeply held principles and convictions. I myself repeat certain Buddhist verses every morning. The verses may look like prayers, but they are actually reminders. Reminders of how to speak to others, how to deal with people, how to deal with problems in one's daily life, things like that. So for the most part, my practice involves reviewing the importance of compassion, forgiveness, all these things. And of course, it also includes certain Buddhist meditations about the nature of reality, and also certain visualization practices. So in my own daily practice, my own daily prayers, if I go leisurely, it takes about 4 hours. It's quite long.
The thought of spending 4 hours a day engaged in spiritual practices raised a question about how to make time for spiritual exercises and prompted one of the Dalai Lama's most enlightening observations about the limitless nature of a spiritual life.
If you make the effort, you can always find some time, say in the early morning, or sometime like the weekend, you can sacrifice some of your fun. So at least I think daily, say half an hour. Or if you make the effort, try hard enough, perhaps you may be able to find 30 minutes in the morning and 30 minutes in the evening. If you really think about it, maybe it is possible to figure out a way of getting some time. However, one should not confine one's understanding of spiritual practice only in terms of some physical activities or verbal activities, like doing recitations of prayers and chanting. If your understanding of spiritual practice is limited only to these activities, then of course you will need a specific time, a separate, allotted time to do your practice. Because you can't go around doing your daily chores like cooking and so on while reciting mantras. That could be quite annoying to people around you. However, if you understand spiritual practice in its true sense, then you can use all 24 hours of your day for your practice. True spirituality is a mental attitude that you can practice at any time. For example, if you find yourself in a situation where you might be tempted to insult someone, then you immediately take precautions, restrain yourself from doing that. Similarly, if you encounter a situation where you may lose your temper, immediately be mindful and say, "No, this is not the appropriate way. That is actually a spiritual practice. Seen in that light, you will always have time." This reminds me of one of the Tibetan Kadampa masters, Potawa, who said that for a meditator who has a certain degree of inner stability and realization, every event, every experience you are exposed to comes as a kind of teaching. It's a learning experience. I think this is very true. So in speaking of having a spiritual dimension to one's life, We have identified one's religious beliefs as one level of spirituality. Now, regarding religion, if you believe in any religion, that's good. But even without a religious belief, we can still manage. In some cases, we can manage even better, but that's our own individual right. If we wish to believe, good. If not, it's all right. But then there's another level of spirituality. That is what I call basic spiritual values, basic human qualities of goodness, kindness, compassion, caring. So this, whether you are a believer or a non-believer, this kind of spirituality is very essential. I personally consider this second level of spirituality to be more important than the first, because no matter how wonderful a particular religion may be, it will still only be accepted by a limited number of human beings, only a portion of humanity. But as long as we are human beings, so long as we are members of the human family, all of us really need these basic spiritual values. Without this, human existence remains hard, very dry. As a result, the individual himself or herself cannot be a happy person. One's whole family will suffer, and then, eventually, society will be more troubled. In general, it is possible to indicate your particular religious or spiritual way of life through external means, such as wearing certain clothes, or having a shrine or altar in your house, or by doing recitations and chanting and so on. However, these practices or activities are secondary to conducting a truly spiritual way of life based on the basic spiritual values, because it is possible that all these religious activities can still go along with a person harboring a very negative state of mind. But true spirituality should have the result of making a person calmer, happier, more peaceful. So engaging in training or a method of bringing about inner discipline within one's mind is the essence of a religious life, an inner discipline that has the purpose of cultivating these positive mental states. Thus, whether one leads a spiritual life depends on whether one has been successful in bringing about that disciplined, tamed state of mind and translating that state of mind into one's daily actions.
The Dalai Lama's own ever-present sense of compassion was demonstrated over and over during his time in Arizona, as I saw people from all walks of life transformed by their contact with him, sometimes in just the briefest of moments. One afternoon, the Dalai Lama was due to attend a small reception. Outside the reception room, a large crowd had gathered in anticipation of his appearance. By the time he arrived, the crowd had become quite dense. Among the onlookers was a man of indeterminate age, possibly in his mid-20s or early 30s, tall and very thin. He was notable for his disheveled appearance, but he had caught my attention because of his expression, for it was one that I had frequently seen among my patients: anxious, profoundly depressed, in pain. As the Dalai Lama arrived, the crowd condensed, pressing forward to greet him, and the security staff, most of them volunteers, struggled to hold back the advancing mass of people and clear a path to the reception room. The troubled young man, now with a somewhat bewildered expression, was crushed forward by the crowd and pushed to the edge of the clearing made by the security team. As the Dalai Lama made his way through, he noticed the man, broke free from the mooring of the security crew, and stopped to talk to him. The man was startled at first and began to speak very rapidly to the Dalai Lama, who spoke a few words in return. I couldn't hear what they were saying, but I saw that as the man spoke, he started to become visibly more agitated. The man continued to speak, but instead of responding, the Dalai Lama spontaneously took the man's hand between his, patted it gently, and for several moments simply stood there, silently nodding. As he held the man's hand firmly, looking into his eyes, it seemed as if he were completely unaware of the mass of people around him. The look of pain and agitation suddenly seemed to drain from the man's face, and tears ran down his cheeks. Although the smile that surfaced and slowly spread across his features was thin, a look of comfort and gladness appeared in the man's eyes.
Sixth Meditation, The Nature of the Mind.
For the Dalai Lama, inner discipline is the basis of a spiritual life. It is the fundamental method of achieving happiness. As he explained, this discipline involves confronting and actively combating negative states of mind such as anger, hatred, and greed, and cultivating states such as kindness, tolerance, and compassion. He's also pointed out that a happy life is built on a foundation of a calm, stable state of mind, and thus the practice of inner discipline can include formal meditation techniques that are intended to help stabilize the mind and achieve that calm state. At the conclusion of his series of public talks in Tucson, he presented instruction on one meditation designed to help us begin to quiet our thoughts, observe the underlying nature of the mind, and develop what he calls a stillness of mind.
The purpose of this exercise is to begin to recognize and get a feel for the nature of our mind, at least on a conventional level. Generally, when we refer to our mind, we are talking about an abstract concept. Without having a direct experience of our mind, for example, if we are asked to identify the mind, we may be compelled merely to point to the brain. Or if we are asked to define the mind, we may say it is something which has the capacity to know something which is clear and cognitive. But without having directly grasped the mind through meditative practices, these definitions are just words. It's important to be able to identify the mind through direct experience, not just as an abstract concept. So the purpose of this exercise is to be able to directly feel or grasp the conventional nature of the mind. So when you say the mind has qualities of clarity and cognition, you will be able to identify it through experience, not just an abstract concept. This exercise helps one to deliberately stop discursive thoughts and gradually remain in the state for longer and longer duration. As you practice this exercise, eventually you will get to a feeling as if there is nothing there, a sense of vacuity. But if you remain there and go farther, you eventually begin to recognize the underlying nature of the mind, the qualities of clarity and knowing. It is similar to having a pure crystal glass full of water. If the water is pure, you can see the bottom of the glass, but you still recognize that the water is there. So today, let us meditate on non-conceptuality. This is not a mere state of dullness or blanked-out state of mind. Rather, what you should do is, first of all, generate the determination that I will maintain a state without thoughts. The way in which you should do that is this. Generally speaking, our mind is predominantly directed towards external objects. Our attention follows after the sense experiences. It remains at a predominantly sensory and conceptual level. In other words, normally our awareness is directed towards physical sensory experiences and mental concepts. But in this exercise, what you should do is to withdraw your mind inward. Don't let it chase after or pay attention to sensory objects. At the same time, don't allow it to be so totally withdrawn that there is a kind of dullness or lack of mindfulness. You should maintain a very full state of alertness and mindfulness, and then try to see the natural state of your consciousness. A state where your consciousness is not afflicted by thoughts of the past, the things that have happened, your memories and remembrances, nor is it afflicted by thoughts of the future, like your future plans, anticipations, fears, and hopes, but rather try to remain in a natural and neutral state. This is a bit like a river which is flowing quite strongly, in which you cannot see the riverbed very clearly. If, however, there was some way you could immediately stop the flow from both directions, from where the water is coming and to where the water is flowing, then you could keep the water still. That would allow you to see the base of the river quite clearly. Similarly, when you are able to stop our mind from chasing sensory objects and thinking about the past and future and so on, and when you can free your mind from being totally blanked out as well, then you will begin to see underneath this turbulence of the thought processes. There is an underlying stillness, an underlying clarity of the mind. You should try to observe or experience this. At the initial stage, when you begin to experience this underlying nature state of consciousness, you might experience it in the form of some sort of absence. This is happening because we are so habituated to understanding our mind in terms of external objects. We tend to look at the world through our concepts, images, and so on. So when you withdraw your mind from external objects, it's almost as if you can't recognize your mind. There's a kind of absence, a kind of vacuity. However, as you slowly progress and get used to it, you will begin to notice an underlying clarity, a luminosity. That's when you begin to appreciate and realize the natural state of the mind. To begin, first do 3 rounds of breathing and focus your attention simply on the breath. Just be aware of inhaling, exhaling, and then inhaling, exhaling, 3 times. Then start the meditation.
The Dalai Lama removed his glasses, folded his hands in his lap, and remained motionless in meditation. Total silence pervaded the hall as 1,500 people turned inward in the solitude of 1,500 private worlds, seeking to still their thoughts and perhaps catch a glimpse of their own true nature. After 5 minutes, the silence was broken as the Dalai Lama began to chant softly in Tibetan, his voice low and melodic, gently leading his listeners from their meditation. At the close of the session that day, as always, the Dalai Lama folded his hands together, bowed to his audience out of affection and respect, rose, and made his way through the surrounding crowd. His hands remained clasped together, and he continued to bow as he left the room. As he walked through the dense crowd, he bowed so low, in fact, that for anyone who stood more than a few feet away, he appeared to be lost in a sea of heads. From a distance, one could still detect his path, however, from the subtle shift in the crowd's movement as he passed along. It was as if he had ceased to be a visible object and had simply become a felt presence.
You've been listening to The Art of Happiness by His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Howard C. Cutler, M.D. Featuring His Holiness the Dalai Lama. It was read by Howard Cutler with Ernest Abuba. It was adapted for audio by Sarah Montague. The recording engineers were Paul Ruest and Bob Schreiner. Editing and post-production by Paul Ruest. Thanks to Arizona Teachings Incorporated for providing original recordings of the Dalai Lama. The associate producer was Sloan Seaman. It was directed by Karen Frillman and David Purdom. The Art of Happiness was produced by Karen Frillman. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.